It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Deadly blasts kill dozens in Kaduna, Nigeria. A doctor falls ill in the midst of West Africa's Ebola outbreak. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. In Nigeria, two blasts Wednesday rocked the northern city of Kaduna, with the first killing at least 25 people, the second killing dozens of others. The police commissioner, Umar Shehu, was on hand shortly after the blast.
Will you say that the attack was targeted at the Sheikh?
He says the first blast apparently targeted the convoy of Sheikh Tahiru Bauchi, a moderate Muslim cleric who has been critical of the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. The cleric, who had just finished preaching in a public square, was unharmed. Police say a second explosion ripped through a crowded market. Initial reports say that attack may have targeted senior Nigerian opposition leader Muhammadu Buhari. Explosions occurred the same day activists marked the 100th day of captivity for more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Ahead of Wednesday's events, organizer Buki Shonabari expressed optimism the girls would soon be freed.
We believe that anything can happen swiftly. So if there's anything we expect from the president and we hope will happen, it is for our girls to return now. So that instead of commemorating the 100, we all come out, jump on the street, dance, and celebrate the gallant return of our girls.
The rallies came a day after President Goodluck Jonathan held his first meeting with some parents of the kidnapped girls, along with some of the girls who managed to escape their captors. Another killing in the Somali capital Mogadishu of a prominent parliamentarian, this time popular singer Sado Ali Warsama. The militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the shooting, which occurred outside the Ambassador Hotel in Mogadishu. Ms. Warsama was a well-known singer formerly based in the U.S. northern city of Minneapolis. She returned to Somalia 2 years ago. She was the fourth member of parliament to be gunned down by Al-Shabaab this year. Meanwhile, the U.S. government announced the arrests of three women on charges of providing material support to Al-Shabaab. The Justice Department said authorities arrested two of the women in the United States. A third was apprehended in the Netherlands. The UN Humanitarian Office is directing $75 million in emergency aid to 11 African countries where increasing numbers are struggling with hunger and malnutrition. $20 million will go to Somalia, where drought, conflict, and soaring prices have left millions short of adequate food. Neighboring Ethiopia will receive $12 million. Kenya allocated $10 million. Other countries receiving smaller amounts include Eritrea, Niger, Cameroon, Senegal, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, Nigeria, and the Gambia. In Malawi, the push for a more equitable gender representation in public life, known as 50-50, gained some momentum in the recent election, but fell short of expectations. Only 32 seats in parliament went to women in the May 20th ballot. That's down from 43 in 2009. Lamech Messina reports.
Gender activists say the poor performance of women candidates in the May elections was shocking, and they have not yet determined the cause. Emma Gali is the national coordinator for the NGO Gender Coordinating Network, which championed the campaign.
Basically, what I can say is that all what was supposed to be done was done, and therefore we did not expect to have the numbers that we got eventually.
Throughout the campaign, her organization was providing financial, material, and more support to all the women candidates, regardless of political party affiliation. In addition, the more than 250 women candidates for parliament and 2,000 women campaigning as councillors were trained in public speaking techniques and skills on how to attract voters. But this did not work to the expectations of the campaigners. Karia says changes are needed in Malawi's electoral system. Meanwhile, the gender activists in Malawi are expected to hold a conference in August to discuss what went wrong for women in the elections. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
A 39-year-old doctor leading the fight against Ebola in Sierra Leone has come down with the virus himself. The health ministry said Dr. Umar Khan has been transferred to a facility run by Doctors Without Borders. The news comes days after three nurses at the same facility in Kanema died from the Ebola virus. The World Health Organization says more than 500 have died from Ebola across Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. A South African court sentenced a rhino poacher to 77 years in prison for poaching and related offenses, including murder. The National Park Service announced Mandla Chowkey's sentence Wednesday, calling it a huge triumph for the rhino. National Park officials say Kruger's Park has lost 370 rhinos to poachers this year. I'm Victor Beatty reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Dozens of people are dead from bombings in Nigeria's northern Kaduna city.
We saw casualties. So many people died. They say the bomb just blast now. And when Sheikh Dairo Bauchi closed his tap, so when he was passing, when he was going home, immediately after he passed, the bomb just blast.
That's eyewitness Lawan Chiroma in Kaduna City. Liberia seeks clarification from the U.S. on the revocation of visas belonging to some senior government officials. Ghana uses World Bank loans to fund free sanitary pads for schoolgirls. And South Sudan blames rebel intransigence for stalled peace talks.
As I speak to you now, the negotiating team of the Republic of South Sudan is ready. We have never left the peace table. The talks were stalled and delayed because of the intransigent position of the rebel group.
Barnaba Merab Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. We'll have a report on President Obama's Young African Leadership Initiative. And from the International AIDS Conference in Australia, we'll examine AIDS at the workplace. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Police in northern Nigeria say at least 25 people were killed Wednesday in a bombing targeting a prominent sheikh. Less than 3 hours later, a VOA reporter counted dozens of bodies at another blast site in the same city. Heather Murdoch has more for VOA from Abuja.
At the scene of the first blast in Kaduna, witnesses say the bomb appeared to be targeting Sheikh Dahiru Bauchi, who had just finished an outdoor service for thousands of people. This is Lawan Chiroma.
We saw casualties. So many people died. They say the bomb just blast now. And when Sheikh Dairo Bauchi closed his tap, so when he was passing, when he was going home, immediately after he passed, the bomb just blast.
There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack, but Sheikh Bauchi is known for preaching against insurgent group Boko Haram, calling it un-Islamic. Boko Haram has killed thousands of people in the past 5 years, including other sheikhs who preached against extremism. Boko Haram has also killed hundreds of school children and has been holding more than 200 teenage girls captive now for 100 days. Police Commissioner Umar Usman Shehu said the bomber was a boy in a vehicle who died in the attack.
The boy is scattered, his leg, his head, everything separate.
After the bombing, police threw tear gas to force people away from the scene, fearing another attack in the same place. But the next bombing was on the other side of Kaduna in a busy marketplace. Witnesses say dozens of bodies lay scattered on the ground afterward. Opposition leader and former president Muhammadu Buhari, who was in the area, escaped. Kaduna is outside the region of northern Nigeria under emergency rule, but it has been attacked by insurgents many times. Authorities on Wednesday imposed a 24-hour curfew. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The Liberian government says it has made proper representation to the U.S. Embassy in Liberia, seeking clarification on why the visas of three senior Liberian government officials were revoked after they had left Liberia. The three officials are Associate Justice of the Supreme Court Kabina Jane, Youth and Sports Minister Eugene Nabe, and Senator Gerundi Dor Sharif. All three once had affiliations with different rebel groups during Liberia's civil war, which lasted from 1989 to 2003. The visa incidents and the arrest and detention last month in the U.S. of Jokun T. Thomas Woweyu, Charles Taylor's former defense minister on war crimes and crimes against humanity, have led to speculations that the Obama administration might be ready to go after Liberians accused of war crimes during the civil war. Liberia's Information Minister Louise Brown described the visa incident as serious and says his government wants to know what really happened.
So far, we have made the proper representation through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to the American Embassy accredited near our capital, seeking information on the revocation of visas of at least three individuals who are serving at very high levels in the government. We are still waiting for feedback from the embassy as to these situations.
Mr. Minister, when you say that your government has made proper representation, tell me, what did you say to the U.S. embassy or the U.S. government?
First of all, we're inquiring, as every responsible government does, And so our inquiry is basically to get information as to what may or may not have happened. We know that at least three senior officials' visas were revoked. It is within the province of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to make such representation and to get the information. Until we do, we like to think there may have been some misunderstanding. It's a process issue, perhaps. So we want to see what goes on.
The three individuals involved, my understanding is that all three of them were some way or the other involved in the Liberian Civil War. Did the embassy tell you that the revocation of these visa is in line with an attempt by the U.S. government to now begin to go after people who, for some reason, might have been involved in the war?
No, we don't have that information, nor has that information been communicated to the government. We've heard about all these speculations. We cannot comment or verify on any of these speculations. We do know, however, that if it relates to any such speculation, it will be communicated to the government. And we believe that once we have that information, we'll make it available to everyone involved.
Many of you or many people serving in that government might have one way or the other been involved in the Liberian Civil War. Is there a concern about trying to send people from your government to come to the United States now because of what happened?
Well, look, we do not want to rush to any conclusion. We do not want to participate in these speculations. And so what we want to do is to, as we've done, do a formal request for information about what may or may not have occurred. I think people are running to conclusions and may find it totally unnecessary in the end. But we have made those representations and will expect to get the results that we need, and then we will determine further actions after that.
So how soon before your government hears from the U.S. Embassy or the U.S. government?
These are serious, and our expectation is that it will be treated with the seriousness it deserves.
Liberia's Information Minister Louis Brown was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Ghana's government says it plans to use some of its World Bank loans to fund a free sanitary pad program for young girls in poor rural communities to reduce dropout rates. Joanna Mate reports from Accra.
The initiative is part of a program known as the Ghana Secondary School Improvement Project. Under the plan, $156 million will be used to build community high schools. The rest of the funds will be channeled into a scholarship scheme for students in poor rural communities, as well as for free distribution of sanitary pads. Studies conducted in Ghana show that the provision of free sanitary pads improved school attendance by cutting absenteeism among girls from 21% of school days to 9%. Ellen Jah is a programs manager at non-profit gender advocacy group Abantu for Development. She says in Ghana, more girls enroll at the basic school level, but a significant number drop out over time, usually after the onset of menses. Apart from pains associated with menstruation, Jah says it is the lack of money to buy sanitary pads that keeps girls at home and out of the classroom. Jah says female education has been proven to be key in development of any society, and this is rightfully a priority for government funding.
One of the backlash that has faced many of these women is, what is your educational qualification? And so education is very prime to even getting a voice in our governance processes. So education is pivotal in our development, and more specifically for women, because there is a lot of research that has shown that when we support women, when women are empowered, the economic development of the country also gets better.
Jah says other benefits of educated girls include fewer teen pregnancies, lower HIV transmission, and reduced infant mortality. More than 10,000 students are expected to benefit under the government scholarship program. Joanna Mante for VOA News, Accra.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 24th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's foreign minister says the stalled peace negotiations in Ethiopia's capital are due to the intransigence of representatives of rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar. Barnaba Merab Benjamin called on the international community to pressure the rebels to end the fighting, insisting that President Salva Kiir is committed to ending the conflict. Benjamin tells reporter Peter Clotty that the government has instructed its troops to strictly adhere to the ceasefire agreement, except in cases of self-defense.
I think the rebel desire to visit and talk to Uganda really is not to talk about the issue of Ugandan forces in South Sudan, because this is a sovereignty issue that connects the two countries. And by the way, the Ugandan forces are there because there are other important issues that are taken care of. The issue, for example, of the Lord Resistance Army, which is causing havoc in our region, including South Sudan, Uganda, DRC, and Central African Republic, including even the Sudan. So this is an area where the issue of Law Resistance Army is a nuisance in the first place. Secondly, this is a bilateral agreement. These are the norms of the sovereignty of states. They can have troops in each other's country. So I don't think that is the issue. I think the issue they're going there, it maybe is to get more advice how they should listen to the voice of peace.
When does the government intend to begin the next round of talks with these rebels following the rebels attacking some parts of the country, breaking the ceasefire agreement signed between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar?
As I speak to you now, the negotiating team of the Republic of South Sudan is ready. We have never left the peace table. The talks were stalled and delayed because of the intransigent position of the rebel group, that they didn't want to attend the peace talks or continue talking on the issues of peace because they didn't like the stakeholders and the former detainees to be a part of the negotiating team. So the problem is with the rebels. As you can see, for the first time, the IGAD mediators, including the international community, have now realized those who are violating the cessation of hostilities are the rebels themselves. Our troops still have got orders to respect the ceasefire only in self-defense should they respond. So we will obey and we will stick to the cessation of hostilities. But the international community, they must come out clearly and tell these rebels that they should respect what they have signed.
You are currently in Kenya attending the Great Lakes Regional Meeting about youth unemployment in the area. What impact will this meeting have on your country's young population?
60% of our population is young. That is between ages of from 15 to 35. It means we have a huge problem. Because of the youth unemployment, you get things like cattle rustling in my country. You get when there is a rebel movement, a lot of young people are recruited and misled, like the present rebellion in my country. So it is a very, very important forum, not only for South Sudan, not only for the Great Lakes region, but for the whole continent of Africa.
Barnaba Merab Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. President Barack Obama's Young African Leadership Initiative has brought hundreds of young Africans to the United States for a six-week program aimed at building their knowledge and skills in fields such as public administration and business. Out of the 50,000 young Africans who applied for the program, just 1% was accepted. VOA's Laura Bowman caught up with some of those who made the cut and has this report.
The Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI, brought 500 young people from across the African continent to the United States to study business and entrepreneurship, public management, and civic leadership at 20 American universities. President Obama unveiled the initiative in 2010.
I launched this effort because I believe that the future of Africa will be defined by extraordinary young people like you.
Intensive coursework is part of the six-week program, and the YALI fellows are also visiting major U.S. corporations, volunteering at community-level organizations, and meeting local government leaders. Eric Ntumba of the Democratic Republic of Congo is studying public management at the University of Arkansas in the town of Fayetteville, and he got to meet Fayetteville's mayor.
Are we learning from people who are already public, high-profile public servant?
A big part of the experience is the chance to meet and exchange ideas with other young African leaders who share their aspirations. Sani Bello and Amina Ahmed, both from Nigeria, say This is an important achievement in the time they have spent as Yali Fellows at Howard University.
We are from different countries, but I've come to meet people of like minds. We are all thinking in the same direction. How do we develop our countries? How do we develop the continent, Africa?
Amina and Sani are coming to the end of their stay here in Washington. We caught up with them in class at Howard University's Business School, where Yali students presented their ideas to one another. Amina and Sani both say the business classes have been life-changing, but they say it's the American spirit of volunteerism they hope to put to use right away.
Service leadership, community, giving to the community, paying it forward.
Leadership is not just about leading. It's all about serving.
You can see this is where I used to boil my water.
Between classes and site visits, each of the Nigerian students had a chance to rest at their apartments and reflect on their experiences.
I would like to check my Facebook page.
What would you like to say to all the women out there who might be watching this?
I would like to say to them that education is power. With education, you get liberated. With education, you become empowered.
There are some things that we can do on our own that can drive development.
And they're off again, headed to visit a Washington think tank. And soon, it's back to Africa and forward to their futures as Africa's rising stars. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
As the AIDS epidemic matures, the issue of AIDS in the workplace has also grown in importance. It's one of the many social issues being discussed at the 20th International AIDS Conference. VOA's Anita Powell reports from this year's conference in Melbourne, Australia.
The vast majority of AIDS patients are of working age, according to statistics from UNAIDS. And so, as the working population changes, AIDS activists say the workplace also needs to adapt. Many organizations, including the UN's Labor Agency, have called on businesses to create HIV-friendly policies for the workplace. But how that will actually play out in the workplace varies widely from country to country. Some nations, like Australia, which has a low AIDS prevalence rate of about 0.2%, have proactive, federally funded workplace programs and progressive policies. Australians also enjoy national health care, which provides a safety net for employees. Brent Allen, who is on the AIDS Conference's organizing committee and is based in Melbourne as the head of Living Positive Victoria, says he challenges all workplaces to set up HIV policies.
This is a policy that caters to the well-being of their employees. If their employees are feeling good, if their employees are healthy, they're going to be more productive.
In the United States, David Phillips, who works for the government-run National Institutes of Health, says he has had HIV his entire working life, since he was 17. He says he welcomes one recent development in U.S. policy, the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which he says offers HIV patients the flexibility to change jobs without losing their HIV coverage under their private insurance plan. At the office, he offers simple advice to colleagues and bosses.
Would say the big thing is to try to keep as much normalcy about the situation as possible. It's really to say that, hey, you know, we can perform well.
That does not mean, he says, that HIV does not affect workers. But in other nations, particularly within sub-Saharan Africa, which has the world's highest AIDS rate of about 4.7%, working with AIDS is not always so easy. AIDS patients, who are overwhelmingly female, often face discrimination. In the southern African nation of Malawi, Safari Mbewe, the executive director of the Malawi Network of People Living with HIV, says AIDS support systems need to come into the workplace with voluntary and confidential HIV support programs.
If we could explore the possibility of having these facilities within the workplace, so each and every company, each and every organization should have a facility within their campus that should take care of their employees. So when an employee needs HIV testing, an employee needs ARVs, they don't have to go elsewhere, because this is what is affecting the productivity as well.
Mbewe says he's heard countless tales of workers being fired for their HIV-positive status in Malawi. The conference has already dedicated many hours to this workplace discussion, but throughout, the underlying message is the same around the world. People with HIV want to work. Anita Powell, VOA News, Melbourne, Australia.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the IAAF World Junior Athletics Championships in Eugene, Oregon State in the United States of America. Alemito Heroye and Alemito Hawi clinched a 1-2 Ethiopian triumph in women's 5,000 meters on Wednesday. Heroye edged Hawi for the gold medal in a time of 15 minutes and 10.08 seconds. Kenyan Agnes Jebet Tirop claimed the bronze medal, while Stella Chesang established a Uganda junior women's record of 15 minutes and 53.85 seconds. Earlier on, Wellington Zaza clocked 13.53 seconds to improve the Liberia junior men's 110-meter hurdles record in his semi-final. Zaza has qualified for the finals, while Avon Trinianina Rakoto Arimiandri ran a lifetime best of 51.96 seconds to establish a new Madagascar junior men's 400-meter hurdles record in his heat. He is through to the semifinals. Staying in Eugene, Ethiopia is fourth on the medal table at the end of day two at the championships on Wednesday. They have a gold medal and a silver medal. Uganda is fifth, while Kenya is eighth among 18 countries on the medal table. Turning to women's football, despite a dip in performance at the last two editions of the African Women's Championships, Ghana is confident they'll excel at the event in Ufintuk, Namibia in October and qualify for the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyantiji explains.
Now, it's important that we make it to Canada 2015, having missed out on Germany 2011. We were in China 2007, and everyone knows the pedigree of Ghana in women's football. We have been to all the World Cups for the under-17 since 2008. For the under-20, we have been to the two previous World Cups. We are going to Canada this year, and that shows some consistency. Most of these young ladies who passed through the under-17 under 20 are now playing the senior team. So we now have a stronger team, and we are very hopeful that the team will make it to the World Cup.
That was Kwesi Nyantiji, Ghana Football Association president, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Here's our listener mail for this Thursday morning, July 24th.
The scripture says, what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And I am asking, what shall it profit the Boko Haram if they shall kill all Nigerians and lose a nation? It is better to present their grievances openly to Mr. President for an amicable dialogue. I am Prince John Michel Obanuku in Obutukato Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A 39-year-old doctor leading the fight against Ebola in Sierra Leone has contracted the virus himself. The health ministry says Dr. Omar Khan has been transferred to a treatment facility run by Doctors Without Borders. Wednesday's news comes days after three nurses at the same facility in Kenema died from the Ebola virus. Two explosions have rocked the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna, with the first blast killing at least 25 people and the second killing dozens more. Investigators and witnesses say the unidentified attackers appear to have targeted prominent Nigerian figures in the blast. That's it for this Thursday, July 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that your Thursday will be a very peaceful one.
Music Time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me. I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa. Every Saturday and Sunday at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC.